Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Saturday the 20th of May, these are our main stories. The United States has endorsed a plan by European allies to train Ukrainian pilots to fly F-16 fighter jets, something Kyiv has been requesting for months. After years of being a pariah on the international stage, Syria's President Assad is back and speaking at an Arab summit. Evidence emerges of Greek government pushback against migrants. Also in this podcast, the World Health Organization is warning of another deadly pandemic, this time cholera, and
the great adventure of humankind pressing out into the cosmos is here.
NASA and Amazon join forces to put astronauts back on the moon. In a major policy shift, the US President Joe Biden says he'll support a European proposal to train Ukrainian pilots to fly advanced F-16 fighter jets. He made the promise at the G7 World Leaders Summit in Japan, where Mr. Biden said the US Air Force would also train Ukrainian pilots. The country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, who'll meet Mr. Biden at the gathering in Hiroshima, hailed the announcement as an historic decision. As Gary O'Donoghue in Washington reports, 15 months after Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Mr. Zelensky is finally getting his wish.
Few details have been given about where and how many pilots will be trained, and ultimately who will supply the actual jets. Indeed, there's no formal commitment at this stage to hand over any planes at all. But the US decision to allow the training to go ahead unlocks many of the legal barriers standing in the way of Ukraine getting the kind of air power it says it needs. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, writing on Twitter, said he welcomed what he called a historic decision, adding it would greatly enhance the country's army in the sky. The Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, also welcomed the decision, saying the UK would be working with other European countries to give Ukraine the air combat capability it needed. Bit by bit, Ukraine is managing to persuade its friends to supply increasingly lethal weapons. First came sophisticated air defence systems, then tanks, and now it's increasingly looking as though modern combat aircraft will be next, though probably not in time for the long-awaited offensive aimed at pushing back Russian troops.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. And there was more good news for the Ukrainian president at the G7 summit, which he's expected to address in Hiroshima. Speaking to reporters, Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz said the group agreed to support Ukraine for as long as it took and to extend targeted sanctions against Russia.
This is sehr wichtig, dass wir.
It's very important that we do everything we can to further refine the sanctions that have already been drawn up, which are aimed at preventing Russia from continuing this war. That's essentially the understanding that we've reached here.
Earlier, the dignitaries visited Hiroshima's memorial to victims of the first atomic bomb, which was dropped on Japan in 1945 at the end of the Second World War. Our correspondent, Laura Bicker, is in Hiroshima, and she's told me about the main talking point.
What has dominated the agenda on the first day is the war in Ukraine. They have announced a new raft of sanctions designed to plug loopholes and go after untapped industries. They're trying to choke off Moscow's war financing, basically isolate Russia even further. Part of the problem is, over the last year, for instance, their sanctions on crude oil, while much of the West has abandoned the use of Russia's crude oil, other countries have filled that gap, including India and China. So there are questions over the effectiveness of these penalties that are being imposed by the members of the G7. They're also saying that will provide further financial and military aid to Ukraine, and that's all ahead of President Zelensky's address. But I think one of the most poignant things that we have seen today are these world leaders gathered at the memorial for the tens of thousands of victims of the first atomic bomb. I mean, they all stood in silence, they held these wreaths and a somber reminder of what this group of seven is trying to avoid in Ukraine.
Laura Bicker, in Japan. Well, on Friday, the Ukrainian president attended an Arab summit in the Saudi Arabian city of Jeddah in an effort to drum up support from Middle Eastern countries to defeat Russia in the war in Ukraine. Also there was the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad, who has Russia and Iran to thank for coming to his rescue during his country's brutal civil war. Some Arab countries, Saudi Arabia among them, armed and paid rebel groups to try to end Assad's rule. But 13 years after he last spoke at an Arab League summit, the Syrian leader was back and took a swipe at America and its allies, as well as calling for a new era of solidarity in the Middle East.
Due to the hegemony of the West, which is devoid of ethics and friends, we have an historic opportunity to rearrange our affairs with the least intervention of the West and the foreign forces in order to have our place in this new world effectively.
The U.S. has made clear it's opposed to the normalization of relations with Damascus and said sanctions should not be lifted. More than 500,000 people were killed in the civil war in Syria. Millions were displaced, and the UN has implicated President Assad in war crimes. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, is in Beirut, and I asked him what's behind this remarkable turnaround for Bashar al-Assad.
The Arab states are, they would say, reflecting reality. Assad is a fact of life in the region, and effectively he has won the war. It's not intense as it was, but people are still being killed. There's still shelling in places. But everybody knows what the result is now, because with the help of the Russians and the Iranians, he recaptured the country, and that has been the case now for a few years. There are other reasons. The Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, has ambitions to remake the Middle East, and he wants to be influential in Syria as part of all that. And there's another reason too, and that is billions of dollars worth of a drug called Captagon are being produced in Syria, and they're going into Saudi Arabia and Jordan and other countries in the region and causing a great deal of addiction. Members of the Assad family have been personally sanctioned by the United States and by the UK because of their involvement in this, some people say more than $50 billion a year it's grossing at the moment. And they want to do something about that. So there are loads of reasons. But of course, for those people who are victims of Assad and people who think he's a despicable, blood-soaked dictator, well, this is really a betrayal in so many ways.
Ukraine's President Zelensky, he's also been at the summit. Let's hear a little from him.
Unfortunately, there are some in the world and here among you who turn a blind eye to those cages and illegal annexations. And I'm here so that everyone can take an honest look, no matter how hard the Russians try to influence.
So, Jeremy, what does President Zelensky want from the Arab League?
If you sit in Europe or the United States, you might get the impression that the support for Ukraine and opposition to the Russian invasion is a worldwide enterprise, but it's not. A lot of the global south and a lot of the Middle East, especially the very wealthy Arab Gulf oil states, are studiously neutral about all of that. So he wants them, as very powerful countries with very considerable militaries, to start supporting him. I don't think it's going to happen, but he wants to win that kind of argument. And I did feel, looking at the pictures of the session, that it was a microcosm, really, of world conflict, because Assad was in the room, Russia's ally, of course, Zelensky was there, Russia's enemy, and there are all those echoes of more than a decade of war in Syria.
Jeremy Bowen. The Greek government has been strongly condemned by rights groups for what could be a violation of Greek, EU and international law. It follows the emergence of video footage appearing to show a group of 12 African migrants, including women and children, being rounded up by Greek coast guards on the island of Lesbos and abandoned at sea on an inflatable raft. The video has been verified by the New York Times newspaper. The incident is thought to have occurred last month and comes ahead of this weekend's general election in Greece, when the topic of asylum seekers is high on the agenda. I asked The Guardian's correspondent in Athens, Helena Smith, to tell me what the video shows.
It's an extraordinary documentation of a forced expulsion, otherwise known as a pushback, of asylum seekers that have reached land, in this case, Lesbos. We see them being taken to a remote spot on the Aegean island in an unmarked white van. From there, they are forcibly placed on a waiting high-speed inflatable dinghy by men in balaclavas. On that inflatable, they are taken to a Hellenic Coast Guard vessel, which then dispatches them to the middle of the Aegean Sea and left until the Turkish Coast Guard picks them up.
And is this the first solid evidence of the government illegally pushing back migrants, something they've always denied?
Yes, it would appear so, because in the past we've had fragmentary evidence of asylum seekers being repulsed by Greek Coast Guard officials in what Greek officials describe as disputed waters before these undocumented individuals enter Greek sovereign territory. In this case, we see an entire group of men, women and children, 12 in all, including a six-month-old baby, being removed from land where they have sought sanctuary and then forcibly placed on a boat which takes them into the middle of the Aegean Sea where they are abandoned.
And what is the government saying now about this?
The government has been slow to react to this. We are literally on the eve of general elections here in Greece. Clearly, the government does not want to make much of this incident.
It has been a huge dilemma, though, for the government, hasn't it? The treatment of migrants, because many Greeks have welcomed the ruling party's tough stance on asylum seekers, haven't they?
They absolutely have, especially on these northeastern Aegean islands, of which Lesbos is the best known. Those communities have really been on the front line of hundreds of thousands of refugees arriving in Greece. Finally, they wanted the government to do something about it. And the government is now touting its migration policies as a huge success, because there has been a radical drop in migrant flows and numbers arriving in Greece.
Helena Smith. Yesterday, here on the Global News podcast, we were reporting on thousands of people being displaced by devastating floods in northern Italy. Today, we turn our attention to Somalia, where drought has been interrupted by floods, forcing a quarter of a million people to flee their homes after the Shabelle River burst its banks. Mohamed Walem from the Somali Disaster Management Agency was there a few days ago, and he told Tim Franks what he'd found.
The river has overflowed its banks due to the heavy rains in the Ethiopian highlands, leading to a rise of water levels. According to the local authorities that we met, up to 80% of the total population in Peledwane have been displaced, about 245,500. This number can change any moment. Up to 450,000 people might be affected overall, living in the riverine communities around the state and beyond.
Now, you were there a couple of days ago. What was the scene like?
It's a scene of really devastation. We have seen an entire population just moving to the outskirts with no provision of food, healthcare. Businesses have closed, food storages have been flooded, healthcare centres have been closed. Most of the time is inundated, actually, forcing residents to move in to the higher ground on the outskirts of the town and to the other remote areas. The only general hospital of the city and the three health centres and four mobile clinics have been closed. The local people that we have spoken to need healthcare and clean water. And it's very sad because we have had a severe drought 2-3 months ago, and now the flooding, and people are now asking clean water.
It's been years that Somalia has been in the grip of drought. I wonder if that makes things worse because the ground is so hard that the water just runs off.
Oh, absolutely. The ground is so hard. Water is actually overslipping the ground. But people have become so vulnerable to the smallest of shocks. This drought started about late 2021, became really severe in 2022. That's one of the drought that Somalia has seen over 40 years, and Somalia went on the brink of famine. So we narrowly averted what could have been a really devastating famine. And now you have the next rainy season of flooding that had affected a number of people, not only in Peledwin right now, but also in Bardere. One of the first things we did was issue an urgent appeal to the situation, because people simply did not understand the magnitude of the situation. So we were quite successful of that. And luckily, we had a number of partners who delivered about 300 water tanks to the immediate families. We dispatched about 50 trucks of food, some medical assistance and some clothes, about 500 tons in total, to the town. We mobilized mobile clinics, but the reality is this is small compared to the realities on the ground.
Mohamed Boualem speaking there to Tim Franks. The US space agency NASA has enlisted the Amazon founder Jeff Bezos to help put astronauts back on the moon. It awarded him a contract to build a lunar landing craft. NASA is already working with another billionaire, Elon Musk. His SpaceX firm is putting together a descent system based on its novel Starship rocket, which will touch down as early as 2025. Here's our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
These are new times. No longer does NASA try to do everything off its own back. It now leans heavily on commercial partners, contracting them to provide space vehicles that in the past the agency would have owned and operated itself. And the latest partner is Jeff Bezos, the online retail entrepreneur. Like that other billionaire, Elon Musk, he has a fascination with space. NASA wants both men to supply landing craft to take its astronauts down to the lunar surface this decade. Mr. Musk will try first. Mr. Bezos will aim to do it in 2029 with his Blue Moon vehicle, which will cost some $7 billion to develop. The NASA administrator, Bill Nelson, is convinced the men's efforts will eventually take humanity to Mars.
So we go to the moon to learn, to live, to invent, to create all these things, to be successful on the moon, to go to Mars. The great adventure of humankind pressing out into the cosmos is here, and this is a part of it.
For the Apollo missions 50 years ago, NASA had just one lunar lander. Having now two options gives it some leeway if one of the men's companies encounters technical problems during development.
Jonathan Amos. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
We can see the average is around 2 millimeters a year, but in certain places it's sinking more like 4.5 millimeters a year. And the other thing we have going on is sea level is coming up at about 2 millimeters a year.
Stay tuned to find out which world famous city is sinking. Welcome back. The United Nations is warning of another pandemic, this time because of cholera. It says a catastrophe is looming, affecting a billion people in 43 countries, unless action is taken to tackle the bacterial disease, which is usually spread through contaminated food and water. It causes diarrhea and vomiting, and youngsters are especially vulnerable. The World Health Organization and the children's agency UNICEF are calling for $640 million in aid. Jerome Fafman-Zambruni is from UNICEF.
Killing the poor right in front of us, and we know exactly how to stop it. We need more support, less inertia from the different global community, because if we don't act now, it's going to get worse, and it's going to reverse all the gain we have made over the past decades on cholera control.
So far this year, 24 countries have reported cholera outbreaks, compared to 15 at this time in 2022. So how critical is the situation? Our correspondent Imogen Folk spoke to me from Geneva, where the WHO has its headquarters.
I think this is very serious. You highlighted some of the gravity of it in your introduction there. 24 countries compared with 15 this time last year. We also have a higher level of mortality in some of the affected countries. And there are a number of factors which are really not helping. Climate change, warmer, wetter weather allows cholera to spread more easily. Now, this is affecting many countries. We also have a depleted, exhausted health system in many countries as well in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. So it's a perfect storm, if you like, which is allowing a disease which, as we heard there, we made good progress against over many years, to now come roaring back and sadly is really spreading in the poorest countries of the world and affecting the most vulnerable, particularly young children.
A lot of people listening to this might be thinking, well, cholera can be prevented through vaccines. Why isn't that happening? Not enough are being produced, are they? Why is that?
There is a cheap and effective vaccine, but there aren't enough of them because there isn't the money being invested. It's not profitable. It's not a problem in wealthy countries. And this is the horrible, tragic story with the production of medicines, that diseases which affect poor countries don't get a lot of investment. Vaccine for cholera, they're now being rationed. This is the thing the UN agencies are trying to call attention to now and did throughout the COVID-19 pandemic as well, is equity for global health. And cholera is perhaps one of the most starkest examples of how unequal access to health and effective treatments is.
Imogen Folkes. On the Global News podcast this time yesterday, we heard about the crackdown on street gangs in El Salvador. Hundreds of abandoned gang safe houses have now been reclaimed and offered to the public through government loans. But as much as some semblance of normality is returning to some districts, thousands of people have spent time in jail on what they say were unconstitutional and illegal grounds. Our correspondent Will Grant reports from the outskirts of the capital, San Salvador.
La Campanera is dotted with empty houses, places the gangs used for rape, murder and torture.
In other cases, the houses are abandoned because the residents have been forced out or have chosen to flee. It's kind of like a ghost town that was created by so many years of gang violence and control in these neighbourhoods. And people are enjoying breathing new air for the first time in many years.
The administration of President Nayib Bukele has started to reclaim those former gang safe houses to turn them over to local residents. Schoolteacher Audelia Rosales received hers through a government loan. As she shows me the refurbishments they're making on the modest house, she says her neighbourhood is finally shedding its violent past.
For the past 10 years, I never said where I lived. The people from here often couldn't find work either. There was such stigma about living in this neighborhood. But now I say it proudly. I'm from La Campanera. It's been a big change for us.
The military-led crackdown has done more than just bring back civic pride. It's had a huge impact on crime in El Salvador, as promoted in slickly produced government videos. The murder rate, once the highest in the world, has plummeted. But the security policy is perhaps the most controversial in the Americas. Human rights organisations say thousands of people with no gang ties have been arbitrarily detained. Union leader Dolores Almendares was one of them. Last year, the police knocked on her door one night and took her away. She didn't see her children for the next 7 months. Only released after tireless campaigning by her fellow union members, today, she describes her treatment in horrific prison conditions as torture.
It was a kidnapping by the state. If you have done something wrong, then you have to pay. But if you haven't, then it's privation of liberty, and that's kidnapping. I would commit no crime, so I shouldn't have been in prison.
I put Dolores's point to the country's Justice and Security Minister, Gustavo Villatoro, in an exclusive interview.
Que no queremos.
We don't want to arrest anyone who offered the gang support, but did so because they were forced to and had no choice. We're not capturing innocent people. What we're currently analysing is whether those who collaborated with the gangs did so because they were trying to become a gang member or had been forced to provide them with support.
For years, the gangs ruled El Salvador under a chilling motto: see, hear, shut up. In essence, it meant see what we do to people, listen to their cries as we torture them in a house next to yours, but keep your mouths shut. Despite the alleged human rights abuses, Mr. Bukele's crackdown enjoys 90% support in El Salvador. And as long as it keeps making such a tangible difference in places like La Campanera, there is no likelihood of it being lifted just yet.
Will Grant. Relatives of a Slovak investigative journalist and his fiancée, who were murdered 5 years ago, have expressed disbelief that the man accused of masterminding the killings has been acquitted for a second time. They say they will again appeal to Slovakia's Supreme Court, which quashed the original verdict in 2020 and ordered a retrial. Marian Kushner was again found not guilty of ordering the murder of journalist Jan Kuciak. From Prague, here's Rob Cameron.
Relatives of Jan Kuciak and his fiancée Martina Kushnirova walked out of the special criminal court before the judge had finished reading the full verdict. Marian Kushner is an enormously powerful businessman, and it was his numerous shady dealings that Jan Kuciak wrote about. But the court decided that only his associate, Alena Zhuzhova, bore criminal responsibility for the contract killings of Kuciak and Kushnirova. While Mr. Kochner has been exonerated a second time, he is not now a free man. He's currently serving a 19-year sentence for an unrelated fraud case.
Rob Cameron. New York has arguably the world's most recognisable skyline, all those high-rise buildings reaching for the sky like so many stalagmites. But there's a price to be paid for so much concrete in such a confined space. The city may be sinking. That's the conclusion of a study by the US Geological Survey. Tom Parsons is one of their geophysicists, and he told Julian Marshall more about the findings of the study.
New York is definitely sinking. It's been doing that for some time at about 2 millimeters a year on average. What we did in our study was to look at the contribution to that from the building load, the construction that's gone on in the city there, and the weight of all those buildings.
So that previous subsidence was caused by what?
It's complicated. The North American continent was covered by ice during the last ice age, and as that melted, it is causing the crust to re-equilibrate. And so part of that is the eastern coast of the U.S. is sinking at about 2 millimeters a year. There's also other effects like pumping groundwater out and soft soils, things like artificial fill that sink under their own weight, and also the building loads that we've been looking at.
So by how much is it now sinking, have you been able to establish?
We can see the average is around 2 millimeters a year, but in certain places it's sinking more like 4.5 millimeters a year. And the other thing we have going on is sea level is coming up at about 2 millimeters a year. So the relative rate is higher.
And can this be slowed in any way?
Not building buildings might slow it a little, but generally this is just going to keep happening.
I mean, it must be one of the most densely populated cities in the world.
Yes, and that's kind of why I wanted to study it, because I wanted to look and see what kind of effect of really deeply concentrated construction would have on the ground.
And this subsidence of the city, does it put it at greater risk from rising seawaters?
Yes, unfortunately, and especially during extreme weather events like some of the hurricanes they've had there recently, where the ocean is riled up and forced its way into land. And so the more low-lying that city is, the more salt water can intrude into the city.
Buildings will continue to be built, but can they be built in such a way that they don't contribute to the weight that is pushing the land down?
It really depends on how the foundation is set up for the building. And most of the big skyscrapers in New York City are anchored down in the bedrock, and that doesn't compress very much. And so if that's done, this effect is very minimal compared to if you build on a softer soil and don't anchor that.
Should residents of the city be panicking?
Absolutely not, no. This is just a scientific study that shows the contribution of the built environment and some of the other anthropogenic causes to subsidence, but it's not an immediate panic, but it is definitely something to bear in mind as new buildings are built.
And you'll be doing this kind of study on a regular basis from now on, will you?
I think the next step is really to start to learn more about the real localized effects of buildings and how they interact with each other, and I think that would require some monitoring and surveying of buildings, I think, is the next direction to go.
Tom Parsons, a geophysicist from the US Geological Survey. The world-renowned Venice Biennale is back. Each year it alternates between focusing on art and architecture. And this year it's the turn of the latter, with a particular focus on Africa. The festival is being curated by the Ghanaian Scottish architect Leslie Loco under the title The Laboratory of the Future. And with more than half of its 89 participants from Africa or the African diaspora, the aim is to rebalance the world's perception of architecture on the continent. Akwasi Sarpong asked Professor Loco if she could define African architecture.
The answer I always give to people is that we're still very much in the process of discovering that, of exploring that. So the Biennale is an extension of that exploration, I think. If people are coming to the exhibition expecting to see buildings or representations of buildings, they may be in for a surprise. I think architecture is a much wider category than the building of buildings, and I think no group of architects exhibits that more clearly than the Africans. So there are people working across all kinds of fields that are maybe historically adjacent to architecture: landscape, urbanism, politics, finance, poetry, performance, areas that I think have something very important to say about the built environment but don't wind up looking like buildings, let's say. I hope people will be pleasantly surprised by the fluidity and the expansion of the term architecture. There are people looking at architecture through the lens of geography and gender, resource use, waste management. I think people have come to this Biennale really seeing it as a way to explore ideas rather than display ideas.
I'm reading your quote from an article in which you say imagination and creativity are perceived as a prerogative of the global north, but you believe in the reverse too, that, quote, beauty and joy and inspiration are both more likely to be found in less prosperous countries and more essential.
Throughout my career, there's been an assumption that it's only the wealthy who have the luxury to be imaginative and to be explorative and to think about aesthetics and beauty and joy and all of those things that I've talked about. And that if you come from societies that have lesser resources, somehow you must be more preoccupied with problem solving. And I would say that the reverse is true, that in societies which are less, and I don't want to say less prosperous, because I think wealth can be found in many different ways, but perhaps less stable, where electricity is less stable, where governance is less stable, where population growths explode. Imagination is absolutely critical, not just to overcome day-to-day challenges, but also because you are really invested in what the future will be like. You can't take it for granted that the future will roll out the way it does, let's say, in the global north. So there is a kind of convergence of activism, politics, imagination, risk-taking, adaptation, innovation that occurs in places where the wealth barometer is less secure. For me, this is an opportunity to bring some of that work to the global table.
Yeah. Is there a worry sometimes that people feel a bit removed from architecture in terms of their everyday lives?
I think so. And I think that's to do with the way we see the profession of architecture. Many people design, they make space, they adapt space, they innovate in their daily lives, but just don't think of it as design. And I think there is a way that architects have removed themselves from the everyday. When I go home to Ghana and people say, what do you do? And I say, I'm an architect. There's always a bit of confusion, like, am I an engineer? Am I a builder? Am I a developer? There's a way of understanding what architects do that I think is quite mysterious. And I'm hoping that in this Biennale and in the conversations that ensue, people will understand that architecture takes place in the everyday. It's not only a professional act, that ordinary people can be involved and passionate and innovative about their built environment.
And the Biennale will be held from Saturday, the 20th of May, to Sunday, the 26th of November. And that's it from us, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Wayne Moses and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.